This is PCJ Radio. Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Hello and welcome to the programme. It's nice to have you with us once again. On this edition, as the Christmas season is just around the corner, we're going to talk about two new books recently published.
That's right. Death of a Pirate and Axis Sally, the American voice of Nazi Germany. So stay tuned. First, we look at some of the headlines in the world of communications. Miroslava Gongadza, the host of Voice of America's popular Ukrainian language television news program CHAS, or Time, has been named one of the 100 most influential women in Ukraine. Ms. Gongadza is 52nd on this year's Focus magazine list, which includes women from politics, business, the media, and other fields. Former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko topped the popular Ukrainian weekly news magazine's annual list last year. Ms. Gongadza was 91st. Voice of America Director Dan Firth W. Austin said, "We are extremely pleased to see Ms. Gongadza recognized for her work and dedication to quality journalism and for the impact her efforts have in Ukraine." The 38-year-old Gongadza says she is honored to be named to the list and happy to be able to provide Voice of America's viewers unbiased and comprehensive news coverage. At the same time, she said, "I feel a great responsibility to keep their trust, especially in these times when freedom of the press in Ukraine is under attack." Ms. Gongadza received political asylum in the United States in 2001 following the murder of her husband, journalist Gheorghe Gongadza. Ms. Gongadza continues to seek justice in her husband's case and is a leading advocate for press freedom. During a recent panel discussion at the National Endowment for Democracy, she expressed alarm at what she described as an increase in harassment of independent media and individual journalists in Ukraine.
The director of broadcasting at Radio Television Hong Kong, that's RTHK, Franklin Wong, has decided not to renew his contract, which expires in February 2011. Mr. Wong, who has headed RTHK for more than 2 years, cited health reasons for his departure. The 68-year-old has been suffering from heart disease. He said he decided not to renew his contract after considering his health condition and the heavy workload of the job. The RTHK head has been criticized by activists for failing to listen to staff's concerns and defend the broadcaster's independence. But Mr. Wong said he had a good relationship with staff during his term. An open recruitment exercise will be held for the post. However, the chairperson of the RTHK Program Staff Union, Janet Mack, said the next director of broadcasting should be promoted internally within the station. RTHK said it respected Mr. Wong's decision to step down and that he made a tremendous contribution to the organization.
Afrikaans station Radio Pretoria has finally been granted a 5-year broadcasting license by the Independent Communications Authority of South Africa, known as ICASA, after a 17-year wait. The station's media spokesman Hank Joubert said, "After a sustained battle of 17 years, Radio Pretoria 104.2 FM has received its broadcasting license. It is clearly written on the license that the station will serve an Afrikaner farmer-based community," he added. An ICASA spokesman confirmed the station had been granted a license. It had been broadcasting on temporary licenses for nearly 2 decades. Joubert said the station had an audience of up to 750,000.
Police in Zimbabwe launched a blitz confiscating shortwave radio sets parceled out to villagers by non-governmental organizations campaigning for the freeing of the airwaves. Information obtained by Radio VOP said that police have been raiding homesteads starting with Morara Center in search of the offending shortwave radio sets, in a civil society organization's view as part of ZANU-PF's strategy to stop rural folk from accessing alternative media sources other than the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation. An official with Zim Rights told Radio VOP that police officers in the company of members of the dreaded Central Intelligence Organization are going through the district threatening villagers in possession of the NGO-donated sets before proceeding to confiscate them. 3 men from Chitoa fell victim to this police raid, but they have been able to identify the police officers who were on duty at the time, the source said. In a statement to Radio VOP confirming the police actions, Zimrights and Harari said police claimed the distribution of the radio sets were done behind their backs and without their knowledge.
And finally, congratulations to Radio Netherlands worldwide journalist Robert Chessel. He and his colleague Hope Domen from the newspaper NRC Handelsblad have jointly won the Magnifying Glass, a prestigious annual prize for investigative journalism in the Netherlands and Flanders. The two journalists were awarded the prize for their series of reports on child sex abuse at Catholic boarding schools in the Netherlands.
Special thanks goes to Andy Sennett of the Media Network blog at Radio Netherlands Worldwide as the source for the material used. You can check them out at http://blogs.rnw.nl/Media Network. And of course, if you didn't have time to write that down, the easiest way to access their blog is through our website at www.pcjmedia.com. If you go to the bottom of our homepage, you'll find a link for the Media Network blog.
Christmas just a few weeks away on this edition of the program, we're going to talk about two recent books that have a historic look at radio. Death of a Pirate by Adrian Johns from Norton Publishing tells the story of Reginald Calvert, the owner of the offshore pirate station Radio City, and his murder by Oliver Smedley.
Calvert was murdered on July 1, 1966. Nearly a year after his death, the BBC launched Radio 1. This book is an absolutely fascinating read. It was written by Adrian Johns, a professor of history at the University of Chicago.
Wonderful Radio London.
Going back in time on the sounds of the nation, it's the Caroline Flashback.
And the pirates were in no way carbon copying some of the format radio that was going on in the United States. So There's layers of copying that go on here, but it's true. You know, the 60s pirate stations did foment a real transformation, mainly in the UK. Actually, slightly earlier on in some continental countries as well in Europe, because the BBC had been to some extent a model for European public broadcasting systems. So there were other countries like Denmark and the Netherlands where there were similar pressures, and pirate radio there too had a transforming effect. It's quite a big deal if you think of the history of how broadcasting had been regulated. That has major implications for public culture, the quality of public discussion, and so forth. And the pirate stations in the 60s were really a turning point in that.
Well, this actually now leads me to the next question. I mean, the pirate radio stations in the UK at the time, they were really seen as pirates. They were seen as they weren't looked upon well by the British establishment at the time, especially the postmaster's office that was aggressively trying to shut them down. And your book, Death of a Pirate, is actually a true account of a crime story that was involving one of these stations. When did you first hear about it?
Okay, this is a story, the outlines of which have actually been known for a long time. But when I came across it, I was in the National Archives in London, actually, which is a huge building in Kew, just to the west of the main part of London, that holds all kinds of state documents going back centuries. And I happened to come across a reference to this legal case that followed on from the shooting. And so just out of curiosity, I called it up. And it turned out to be 1,000 pages long. And it was the entire police investigation and court record of the incident, which turned out to be fascinating. It was almost a kind of anthropological account of the entire culture of pirate radio in the mid-1960s. And it really, I don't think it had been seen by anybody since the trial, which was 66-67.
When you came across the documents, did they show, for example, did they show how the government at the time really viewed the pirates, because, you know, if you look back at some old interviews, quite often there were members of government, MPs, that would say, you know, these people were criminals and they were the lowest form of person in society.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, the state documents do tell you something about, for example, cabinet level discussions about what to do about the pirates in the early to mid 60s. I have to say that the popular image that exists, that the government and the BBC and the Postmaster General were all just, you know, stuffy reactionaries, I don't think that's quite right. I think that they were struggling to deal with questions about media regulation that were actually quite deep and you know, we're going to have long-run effects that were hard to predict. And they, it's true that some of them were just in principle opposed to the idea of, say, commercialization or to pop music itself, which they did see as culturally degrading. But there are others who thought that there should be some compromise possible. At one point, the minister in charge of policy was actually Tony Benn, who has an interesting history himself. You may know he's the doyen of a certain kind of left-wing Labour politician. And for him, I think it was rather a torturous position to be in, because he is a believer in, you know, popular freedom, essentially. But at the same time, he's also a believer in improving the public culture and against commercialization. So I think one of the reasons why the government tended to speak loudly but not do very much was that it was actually rather agonized in the way that Ben himself was about exactly how strict to be and what policies to adopt.
Step up to a new level of musical velvet. Smooth sounds of the smart set. Hallmark of quality, Britain Radio.
Music now. Radio Veronica's your station.
Do you think that also part of the opposition that the government at the time had toward the pirates, especially the BBC, was over some of the rules and regulations that were part of the musicians' union? For example, as you probably are aware, for many years, most of the music that was on the BBC had to be either recorded at the BBC or had to be played live, and they were limited to the amount of records that of studio recordings that they can play a week. But yet, the pirate radio stations, that's all they were playing.
Yeah, that's true. The BBC was under an agreement called Needle Time that dated back to roughly the end of World War II. And it's a kind of collaboration between the musicians' unions and the copyright agencies. In that, what it did was it as you say, it limited the BBC's ability to play records and pop records in particular, partly in a bid to try to preserve as many musicians' jobs as possible. So the BBC were basically doing their own cover versions of things, and this is a kind of interesting point, because there were people within the BBC who would dearly have liked to play more pop music. They thought the BBC was missing out and that it ought to have a more leading role. But they couldn't, because they were running up against Needle Time. And so Needle Time limited the BBC to something like 20 hours a week of playing records. And most of those hours were given over to classical music, because the BBC saw its mission more broadly as cultural improvement, and classical music served that end. And that was really why the BBC was not able to compete in the stakes of popularity with the pirates. The pirates, as you say, were just playing pop music records end to end all day. By about 1965, there were 10 or so pirate stations operating various places around the coast of the UK. And One of them operated out of an old World War II anti-aircraft fort that sits up on stilts out in the North Sea, just off the Thames estuary, and it was called Radio City. And a rival pirate entrepreneur called Oliver Smedley essentially tried to take over Radio City by force, essentially. He hired a bunch of stevedores from the dockyards in London, and they went out in the middle of the night and hijacked the station. This led to a couple of days of angry confrontations with the station's boss, a kind of an enterprising figure called Reg Calvert, which culminated with Calvert turning up at Smedley's house in the countryside at the middle of the night. And there was a brief confrontation, and Smedley shot him. Smedley shot Calvert dead. That shooting was actually the catalyst for the government shutdown of the entire pirate system and a transformation in BBC broadcasting to compensate for that shutdown. There are all kinds of episodes, stories behind why the shooting took place and what the consequences of the shooting were for Smedley's and Calvert's families and party.
You know, it's interesting, actually, when I was reading a little bit about it, because Calvert actually was also, at the time, the manager of a British singer by the name of Screaming Lord Sutch. And one of the stations, actually, that they'd set up was called Radio Sutch. When all this was going on, after he was killed, how much time was there before Radio One was set up?
It's about a year, and that's really for the period for the court case to run through and for legislation to run through the British Parliament. There was a certain debate about exactly how to respond to this, but there wasn't much debate that there had to be a serious response. I think there was a general consensus that pirate radio is one thing, but actually having people shot is a much more serious issue. And the thought was that if pirate radio was going to lead to that kind of activity, then suddenly the government has a kind of mandate, if you will, for shutting it down. So it took about a year for Radio One to be set up. And when it was set up, of course, it recruited a certain number of the DJs straight out of the pirate ships. And along with their format, the idea of jingles, for example, were taken over from the pirate ships. And this was widely recognised, that it was essentially a kind of imitation of that already proven formula.
Now, with the clock ticking slowly up to 7 a.m, it's going to be time to welcome Radio 1's first daily show on 247 metres medium wave, whilst breakfast special continues on Radio 2. 10 seconds to go before Radio 1, Tony Blackburn, and Radio 2, Paul Hollingdale, stand by for switching. Get tuned to Radio 1 or 2, 5, 4, 3. Radio 2, Radio 1, go.
The voice of Radio 1. Just for fun.
Music.
Too much.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the exciting new sound of Radio 1.
When you were researching the book, did you have the opportunity to speak to people that knew Smedley and Calvert?
I spoke to their families. Both families were very helpful to me. I've spoken to a few people who are veterans of the pirate stations of that time. Not so much Radio City, which was Calvert's station, but there are. As you may know, that there's a very lively kind of amateur historian culture about pirate radio in the 60s, which is largely fueled by people who are veterans from that world. So it's possible to find out an immense amount, actually, about what it was like to live on the ships, how the choices of music were made, and things like that. So yes, but there's much more that could be done. I mean, one could find out a lot more about the day-to-day operations, for example, of Project Atlanta, which was Smedley's original radio station.
With these radio stations, does the information, for example, on the day-to-day operations of these stations, does that information still exist in say, printed form, log sheets or memos?
To some extent it does. It would be a question of digging through people's attics, really, for it. So I came across a trove of material to do with Radio Atlanta, Smedley's original station, out in a farmhouse in the far west of England, where the widow of one of the DJs, and in fact Smedley's cousin, still had these things in boxes. So they had things like the advertising rate sheets, the reports that Smedley was making to investors on an annual basis, all that kind of material, which was never really published. It wasn't secret either. It was just, you know, internal corporate documents. And I suspect there's probably quite a bit of that still around somewhere. It would be a question of finding the individual private citizens who would hold on to it.
Were there any surprises that you came across when writing this book?
The book actually goes right back to the origins of broadcasting in the 1920s in order to account for what happened in the mid-60s. And there's a fair amount of surprising stuff to do with the history of public broadcasting through that interim period, in the 20s through the 60s. For example, the strangest thing is a controversy in the late 1930s that came fairly close, actually, to bringing down the BBC at that point, which has to do with an invisible poltergeist mongoose that lived in a farmhouse on the Isle of Man. The editor of The Listener, which was a highbrow magazine sponsored by the BBC, got involved in a project to try to investigate this paranormal phenomenon. And as a result of which, he was the BBC hierarchy essentially kind of lent on him to try to keep quiet when it was pointed out that this may be just crazy. And that led to questions in Parliament about whether the BBC was a kind of incipiently Mussolini fascist organization, because it was tyrannical over its own employees. And this came about at one of the periods when the BBC's charter had to be renewed. So there are parliamentary debates coming from this issue about a ghost mongoose that where MPs were really quite angry and were urging that the BBC essentially should be shut down. It survived that, but still, that was a very strange episode.
Well, with the pirate radio stations, because you mentioned that it goes back to the beginning of the book, of course, goes back to the 1920s and 1930s. The clandestine radio stations that were on the air from the UK during the Second World War, would they or could they be categorized as pirates?
In a certain sense, they could. In the lead up to the Second World War and then through World War II, the British organized clandestine broadcasting into the Reich and into the northern continental Europe. They could be characterized as pirates because by that point there was already an international system of wavelength regulation, according to which it was regarded as unacceptable to broadcast into a neighboring country without that country's approval. So yes, you could have thought of them as pirates, but obviously the role of them was not that of the role of pirates in peacetime. I mean, these were propaganda and to some extent espionage operations. Wherever you go.
Just take a lively companion wherever you go. Take a portable radio. Take a portable radio.
Caroline.
Golly gee, look at
you know time. It's amazing when you think back now, because these pirates really, they were going against the giant, the BBC, and they attracted so many millions of listeners, not just in the UK, but anywhere where the signal could be picked up. There were some cases, of course, that some of the pirates, their signals were even picked up in Northern Africa.
Yeah, that's true. I did come across complaints about interference from pirates that came in from quite long distances to the British government, so Far Eastern Europe, Yugoslavia, places like that. And it's true, they got very large audiences. I believe that even, for example, Harold Wilson, who was Prime Minister at the time, was listening to Radio Caroline, I think. And this was one of the problems that, of course, the government faced, was that the pirates were simply so popular. And this was a time when the two major political parties in the UK never got more than a wafer-thin parliamentary majority one over the other. So taking action against a very popular form of media could well have doomed the government to opposition the next time there was an election. That wasn't an unrealistic fear. That again, is something that tended to constrain the scope of action for the government. One of the interesting things, though, about pirate radio and for that matter, commercial radio in general, opposing the BBC going back into the 30s, is that it did raise the question of how it is that you actually measure audience size and audience response. And I think one of the interesting side stories to this is that the history of attempts to try to gauge the impact of a medium goes back to that issue. You know, how do you tell how big the audience is for unlicensed radio? And it was really that was the commercial unlicensed part of broadcasting that gave rise to a whole discipline of the social science of listening, figuring out how many listeners there are, how they listen, when they listen, and so forth.
Have any of the former pirate DJs contacted you about this book?
Not yet. It's only been out for a few weeks. We did get a letter from Radio Caroline, which essentially complained that I didn't give enough prominence to Radio Caroline, especially in the 1970s, because Caroline, of course, carried on, and it's still around in the form of an internet broadcaster today. You know, that's true enough. My main focus is on the 60s, and I think it's more the case that Caroline revived than it actually carried on without a break. But that's been the only, as it were, written response that I've had from the veterans, other than the people who I'd been in contact with before, who've sometimes written in to just say, to acknowledge that it's appeared, and to, you know, give their own memories of how it correlates with their experiences of being on the ships.
On your TV, because in case you did not know, we're being brought to you by, brought to you on, brought to you by RADI.
And I was speaking there with Adrian Johns, author of Death of a Pirate.
For more information about Death of a Pirate, go to www.wwnorton.com. Another recent book looks at a well-known Nazi broadcaster from German radio during World War II. The story of William Joyce, also known as Lord Haha, has been well documented.
Germany calling. Here are the Reichs in ambush. Station Bremen and Station VXB on the 31-meter band.
Except there was another well-known Nazi broadcaster. She was nicknamed Axis Sally. Her name is Mildred Gillers. Gillers was born in Portland, Maine, November 29th, 1900. She left the United States in 1933 for Paris and ended up in Germany in 1934. In Germany, she studied music and was hired as a teacher. In 1940, however, she landed a job at German radio as a propaganda announcer for the overseas service.
After the war, Giller spent nearly 10 years in prison, serving a sentence on 8 counts of treason at the Federal Reformatory for Women, where, incidentally, more recently, media mogul Martha Stewart served time. After her release from the Federal Reformatory for Women, Giller never talked publicly about her time as an announcer for German propaganda radio. Axis Sally, the American Voice of Nazi Germany by Richard Lucas, is the first fully documented biography of the notorious World War II broadcaster.
Hello, boys. This is Jerry Sprunt calling. This program is specially dedicated to you men of the British Fighting Forces, goes on the air every night from 10:15 p.m. to 11 p.m. on the medium waves 391 and 449.1 meters, and short wave 28, 31 and 39.6 meters.
Well, I had heard several of her broadcasts over the internet, and I started to do more and more research on her, and I realized that there had been no nonfiction biography of her. It was very, very difficult to get any sort of accurate information about her. There had been a lot of myths about how she got to Germany, how she ended up in this position, and I became more fascinated with the story and exactly how this woman got to this position, and it quite simply took her life in a completely different direction. And it's not only an interesting story, it's a tragic one.
The question, though, is how do you research such a thing? I mean, if you talk about, let's say, you know, her life before she went to Germany, that must have been quite difficult, or was the documentation all around?
There were several places to look, including her college archives at Ohio Wesleyan. She had long interviews with the Counterintelligence Corps after the war. And in addition to that, I was able to locate at the Library of Congress papers by a former ambassador who worked for a magazine during her trial. And he had interviewed her sister, her half-sister. And not only in his papers did I find information and notes on her past as a child, but also a trial transcript of the trial itself, which the National Archives in Maryland had lost. So it was difficult. That was probably the most difficult part of writing this book, was what about her time before Germany? What about where was she, tracking her down? Because she was an actress in New York and in Cleveland. And basically you had to track where she was on the road and the things she had become involved with along that time. She had left Ohio with basically $20 in her pocket and without her parents' blessing, and had to make her life as an actress. And in a lot of ways, she failed. So it was a difficult slog for her. And she finally, at the time of the Depression, decided that she would look for greener pastures in Europe.
You know, when we hear the stories of William Joyce, everybody knew that, you know, the story, of course, is that, you know, before he went to Germany, he was involved in the British nationalist movement. Broadcasters, one of the most famous females that was nicknamed Tokyo Rose, she was just an American Japanese who just happened to be in Tokyo at the time and just would have sort of, you know, forced into doing it. But what about with Mildred Gillers? I mean, what was her political background before she went to Germany, and did she just get caught up in the whole movement that was going on in Germany at that time?
She was almost entirely apolitical. I mean, one thing that comes throughout the entire research is that up until that point, she was basically apolitical, but she did fall under the influence of the men in her life, and she also was very susceptible to German propaganda. She lived in Germany from 1934 on, became quite enthralled with the pomp of it all. And she started to actually, she was able to keep jobs. She worked as a film critic. She did dubbing for UFA. She did several different jobs. She wrote for Variety on a per-job basis. So she was more successful in Germany as an American expatriate than she ever was in the United States. And then what happened was she became involved with a German citizen, a man named Paul, and he told her when war broke out that he would not marry her unless she stayed in Germany, that if she went home at the behest of the U.S. Embassy, he would not marry her. And then what ended up happening was, at the end of the day, he was sent to the Eastern Front and was reportedly killed. And she, once again, was alone. Mm-hmm. And by that time, Pearl Harbor had occurred. The United States was in the war, and she had no way out.
You know, it's interesting. When I've listened to some of those broadcasts that she did, despite, you know, the political slant, and when you listen to them today, they are, I mean, the message that comes across is rather disgusting. But from a professional point of view, she was extremely professional in her presentation and even her style. I mean, despite the message, the evil message that she was trying to get across.
Yes, she was good on her feet. As a matter of fact, she bragged to her captors when she was brought over in 1948 to the United States. She was bragging that she had almost done a lot of that stuff. A lot of the words that she spoke were off the cuff. Some of it was written. Some of it was written by her manager and lover, Max Otto Koischwitz. But she was also very adept at being able to work extemporaneously, and was in fact very good at it and very professional.
You're tuned in to German Overseas Service in Berlin, broadcasting to North America. There is the German Overseas Service in Berlin, broadcasting to North America over stations in the 19, 25, 28, 31, and 41 meter bands, which correspond to the 15, 11, 10, 9, and 7 motorcycle bands.
Part of that comes from her acting. You know, she was an actress at heart.
Well, after the war and after she was sent back to the United States, what was life like for her?
She went through a period of the trial where she was completely reviled. And then she served 12 years in a West Virginia prison in Alderson. And some of the listeners might recall that name because Martha Stewart served time there recently.
Mm-hmm.
It was a women's prison. Basically, they would call them cottages. They would use the photo studio and the sewing room and like that. But it was a difficult place because actually one of the best accounts of life in Alderson prison in the 1950s was from a convicted communist who served time at the same time as Mildred.
Mm-hmm.
And she discusses her in some length in her book. But it's very, it was not easy for her. She was very reviled, very, she kept to herself. And whereas she always sought fame in the early stages of her life, and that brought her to Germany and brought her to the radio, later in life she was intensely, intensely private. And when she was released on parole in 1961, she was given a job at a convent in Columbus, Ohio, where she jealously guarded her privacy largely up until her death in 1988.
So when she was released on parole until her death in 1998, she didn't grant any interviews with anybody about what she had done in Germany during the Second World War.
Well, when she was released and she was walking out of Alderson, they followed her. The press followed her along the route from West Virginia to Ohio, and she granted some interviews the day after. But only occasionally would she speak to the press. And in one case, the only reason, and I spoke to the woman who actually took this interview in 1967. She was a young girl. Her father's brother or uncle was a Monsignor in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And Mildred had converted to Catholicism in prison. And she granted an interview with this young girl. As a matter of fact, the reporter told me that when she was a young reporter, it was kind of a joke among the people at United Press. Try to go get an interview with her. That's your first job. And they would laugh. You know, it was like a joke. But she nailed this interview with her in 1967. And, of course, she asked her about the Vietnam War. What do you think of the Vietnam War? And she said, who am I to talk about wars? I don't want any sort of, comment about any wars that have ever gone on, because she was done with politics, done with any sort of political involvement at all. She was jealously private. She would only speak about the church, about prison life, and she changed her life quite a bit in that time.
And Fusilier John Towler, T O W L E R, service number 3865932. His sister, Mrs. E. Tomlinson, lives at 22 Kimberley Avenue, Blackpool, Lancashire.
Do you think, from the research that you were doing and also writing the book, do you think that, you know, she became private because she looked at what she had done, the messages that she was broadcasting, and felt very kind of wished that she hadn't done that?
I think she was a very proud woman, and I think she was very... she was very reticent about being able to say I was wrong. They would ask her, these interviews in 1961, would you have done it differently? She said, of course I would have done it differently, had I known what I know now. And she doesn't really get to the answer of, she always maintained that she did not know what was happening to the Jews in Berlin, even though she was there in Berlin at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But she was very, very adamant about how could I have made any other choice. I think at the end of the day, she had regrets. I'm sure she did. But publicly, she still maintained to stuck to the explanations that you see many people have. Who have been in Vichy or have been involved in the war, that she was either not aware or she was or couldn't have had any other choice.
Mm-hmm. Was there any information when you were writing this that looked into what her life was like at the German radio at that time and relationships that, let's say, she had with William Joyce and other Brits and Americans that were broadcasting propaganda?
Well, she was quite... she had been on the radio with Margaret Joyce.
Oh, okay.
Several times. Now, she lived, and Margaret Joyce was known as Lady Haha. They had largely done programs for women, they would have panels where Mrs. Joyce and Max Otto Koschwitz's daughters would sing, and they would have Constance Drexel and some of the other American radio hosts would be on a panel. As far as Joyce, after some point in the war, he started to broadcast farther and farther away from. They started to disperse somewhere around 1943 when the bombing in Berlin became very, very bad. And the broadcasting house in the center of Berlin, they started to evacuate. They would move to a suburban studio out in out by the transmitters in the suburbs of Berlin. And more and more they would broadcast from Hilversum or from other locations throughout the occupied territories.
This is Berlin calling. Berlin calling the American mothers, wives, and sweethearts. And I'd just like to say, girls, that when Berlin calls, it pays to listen. When Berlin calls, it pays to listen in. Because there's an American girl sitting at the microphone every Tuesday evening at the same time with a few words of truth to her country's women back home. Girls, you all know, of course, by now that it's...
Besides the message that they were trying to convey, they would parody songs that were popular of the day against Churchill, against Franklin Roosevelt.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to some of those recordings, there was one program called Invasion Calling that was almost completely consisting of parodies and that the band would play live. Mildred Gillis was a driving force behind getting the Germans to use the way she phrased it, live bands instead of dead records.
Mm-hmm.
She was just spinning records at one point. She actually complained and said, you know, we need a band in here. So she got a band in her show. And she would, you know, they would call them different things, Charlie and his orchestra or Dick and his foot warmers. But they made it listenable
mm-hmm.
to large amounts of listeners and GIs.
Listen to the BBC, BBC, BBC. Listen to the BBC, tra-la-la-la-la. Who's preaching world democracy, democracy, democracy? Who wants to make free people free, tra-la-la-la-la. First they won the war in France, then they said they had no chance. Each time the Germans did advance, how could they have a chance? They told stories so divine, often marched across the Rhine. Germans eat only rats and mice, but in England all was fine. Bye-bye Churchill, BBC, BBC, BBC. Your tricks won't work with Italy, tra-la-la-la-la. Why not give us different news, different news, different news? Skip those Soviets, skip those Jews, tra-la-la-la-la.
Those broadcasts that were done at the time, is there any estimate around maybe perhaps how many people did actually tune in, or how many people actually heard these broadcasts, or were they targeted mainly towards the military forces in Europe?
Well, early in the war, there were estimates. I know BBC Monitoring did estimates of how many people were listening to Ha Ha. After the 9 p.m. news, and it was probably 1 to 3. And I go over in the book about in Britain there was so little news about what was going on at the time that they would immediately turn to see what Lord Ha Ha was saying to find out what the government was holding back. But as the war went on, it became more targeted towards the U.S. staying out of the war.
Mm-hmm.
That was the propaganda line. And then in 1942-1943, North Africa and the Italian fronts, so much so that the other Axis ally, and there was another Axis ally who broadcast out of Rome after Mildred experienced some success. She was attached to a military unit in Italy as they moved as the Germans retreated. So it became more targeted towards the forces of the British and the United States forces in Africa, North Africa. And some of those broadcasts that Mildred had done, you can actually hear she's targeting the boys in French North Africa. And she will refer to them over and over. As they got closer to the German to the German homeland, they became even more targeted, and you hear accounts from soldiers at that time, or GIs, who say, she knew where I was, she knew where our platoon was, she knew where our company was headed, and that's where you start to realize that she was actually receiving some military intelligence from the Germans to be able to identify where they were. So it became more and more targeted towards the invasion forces in 1944, and as the war went on, it became more specific and more targeted to individual groups.
Richard, one final question. Why did you decide to write this book, and why now?
Well, for one thing, there had been no book on Axis Sally. And secondly, in the United States, we have had the first treason indictment since the 1950s with the indictment of Adam Gadahn for his propaganda work with Al-Qaeda. And I thought it would be timely and interesting and something that no one had ever done before. There have been several books on Tokyo Rose. On how she was located and arrested, but not on Miss Gillers that was nonfiction. So I think it's a good time to start to discuss the meaning of propaganda, the meaning of her actions, and look at it with a view towards what's happening today.
I was speaking there with Richard Lucas, the author of Axis Sally, the American Voice of Nazi Germany, from Casemate Publishing. And we're almost at the end of this monthly edition of Media Network Plus. We will be back December 24th, Paulette. And for December 24th, we have another fascinating show, correct?
That's right, we sure do. We'll be talking about press freedom in Ukraine, or lack thereof. And we'll also be doing something a little more lighthearted.
That's right. We're going to be doing something, wait a second. I've lost my place. Hold a minute. No, that's not the page. Wait a second. I'm looking. Well, we're doing something, what we are doing, actually, we're going to be looking at radio bloopers. That was my little attempt to act it out. Of course, it didn't turn out as good as the real thing. And if you want to hear some of the bloopers from this show that we just did today, tune in December 24th and we'll have a few snippets for you.
Oh, gosh. Keith, you're not going to do that
yes.
to me, are you?
Do you really think I would do that?
Keith, I know you. Okay, stay tuned. I guess it'll be interesting. So if you wish to reach us, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's PCJ, stands for Peace, Cheer, and Joy, pcjmedia@gmail.com. Or you can find us on Facebook. Just do a search for PCJ Media.
If you wish to write us by snail mail, the address is PCJ Media, attention Media Network Plus, 8th floor, number 47, lane 31, that's lane 31, Section 1, Sanmin Road, and that is S-A-N like Norman, M like Mother, I like Ivan, N like Norman Road. I'm running out of air. Banqiao, B-A-N-C-I-A-O, Taipei, Taiwan, ROC 22070. But if you didn't have time to write that down, don't worry. Just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com, and you can find our postal details there.
And having a hard time believing that Keith Perron would run out of air, this is Paulette McCrory in Vancouver, Canada.
Well, considering how much I'm full of it, I'm Keith Perron in Taipei, Taiwan, saying so long and bye for now.
Bye-bye.